Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. In the last few minutes, President Obama announced that Solicitor General Elena Kagan is his choice to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. If she is confirmed, it will be the first time three women justices have served on the nation's highest court at the same time. Joining me to discuss her selection and how she will be received by those on the right and on the left of the political spectrum, in the studio, George Washington University law professor Jeffrey Rosen. Also in the studio with me, Michael Scheer of The Washington Post. And joining us by phone, the National Journal's Stuart Taylor. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me.
Sure. Thank you.
The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. The email address is drshow@wmu.org. We would love to have your questions and comments later on in the program. President Obama, Jeffrey Rosen, has just said that Elena Kagan is widely regarded as one of the foremost legal minds. She is a trailblazing leader. What do we know about her?
She is indeed regarded as one of the foremost legal minds, and by liberals and conservatives alike. What's so striking about Kagan is that at every stage of her career, she's really shown a knack for appealing to her ideological opponents in their own terms and reframing the debate. And I should say up front that I've known her for a long time. We met in the mid-90s. We were both law clerks for the same judge. My brother-in-law is now her deputy. And I've really watched her in meetings. She's able to kind of ask a friendly but pointed question that gets to the heart of whatever is in the other person's mind and then reframe the legal debate in an especially compelling way. And that's what's won her the support of many conservatives, both on the Harvard Law School faculty, where she hired controversial conservatives and won their respect, and also in the Clinton administration, where she was responsible for bringing John McCain around to tobacco reform and forging a kind of new way, a third way, in ways that were especially impressive. Now, the interesting thing about Kagan, though, is that she has detractors on the left and the right, and I know we'll talk about this, but essentially they don't like the fact that she's a centrist, and the enforcers of ideological purity on both extremes are afraid that they don't know enough about her to really be confident, and that's going to be an interesting part of the confirmation discussion.
Michael Scheer, another thing that President Obama said, speaking about her just now, in the East Room of the White House, is that her passion for the law is anything but academic.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the things that you heard a lot that President Obama was looking for in a judge, was somebody who could sort of get beyond the sort of pure academics of the law and sort of understand the law's impact on quote-unquote real people. Last year, he, of course, famously used the phrase empathy, wanted to have a judge that had empathy for the plight of folks. I don't think you'll hear that word this time because it got kind of controversial last time, but you will, you I'm sure, have heard today and will hear throughout the process, the folks on behalf of her talking about that ability to kind of cut through the mumbo jumbo and to understand how the law really affects folks on the ground. And of course, you know, one of the interesting things about her is that she doesn't have any experience as a judge. And so how those two things interact, the fact that she doesn't have that experience, but that the president says, look, she's somebody that can really understand real folks, will be interesting to see.
Right. So how much do we actually know about her judicial positions?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We don't know a whole lot. She hasn't been a prolific speech maker and writer like Sonia Sotomayor was. She doesn't have, obviously, a record of decisions because she's never been a judge.
She's pretty guarded about her personal
views. She seems to be, you know, very, very guarded about her personal views. It was interesting in the New York Times this morning. They did a long profile and even sort of reached back to her writings in college. On the college newspaper and in college to try to get some sense of where she's coming from because there's not a lot out there.
Of course, she has been Solicitor General for the past year, the first female Solicitor General of the U.S. What have we learned about her from that position? Have we learned more about her judicial views, Jeffrey, do you think?
Not from her views as Solicitor General, because there, of course, she's obligated to defend federal laws and to take the position of the government, whether or not she
agrees. And she's made a point of saying that that was her job as Solicitor General.
She has. Now, we certainly saw a very vigorous defense from her of the campaign finance law in the most controversial case of the year. And since many Senate Democrats have expressed interest in exploring the lack of economic populism on the Supreme Court and in accusing the court of being slanted in favor of corporate directions, the exchanges between her and Chief Justice Roberts in that campaign finance argument will no doubt become especially salient. But then she has taken positions as Solicitor General that have upset the left in saying that there's no right of detainees at the Bagram Air Force Base to challenge the terms of their detention. She's taken a position which some have disliked. Of course, we're right in the middle of this big debate about the rights of detainees, with Attorney General Holder just this weekend saying that the administration might reconsider Miranda warnings for detainees. So this question of whether she's more conservative than Justice Stevens, who she'll be replacing, when it comes to detainee and civil liberties issues, will be something that everyone's going
to
explore.
Okay, Stuart Taylor, I know that you've just been listening to the president's announcement and his introduction of Elena Kagan. Elena Kagan is now speaking at the moment. What struck you about what the president said about her and why he chose her?
I'm embarrassed to say that I had trouble with my TV and I actually couldn't watch, but I do have an idea why he chose her, and it has a lot to do with what's already been said, especially by Jeff. She is known as a very able conciliator and consensus builder with a brilliant mind. At Harvard Law School in particular, she won the confidence of conservatives as well as liberals that she was an honest broker, and I think that will all help make the confirmation pretty smooth. I should add that it won't be entirely smooth, apart from the liberal suspicions about her, which won't be a real problem in confirmation terms, that Jeff mentioned. Conservatives will pound away at, especially at her efforts as Dean of Harvard Law School, to exclude military recruiters from campus facilities as a protest against the military law's exclusion of gays from the military. That will be a hot issue in the confirmation hearings, and there will be others. But in general, I think she's she'll be less offensive to conservatives than most imaginable Obama nominees would be.
But Stuart, seven Republican senators voted for her confirmation just last year as Solicitor General. Presumably that suggests that they, at least, are okay with her.
They were
okay with her in that position at that time.
The Supreme Court confirmation is very different.
Right.
Apart from the politics of it, you're confirming somebody who could serve for 40 years if she lives as long as Justice Stevens has, and who will be making the law as opposed to representing the views of the. I think some of those Republicans who supported her for Solicitor General will not support her now. I think she'll get maybe 65 votes. She'll get some Republican support. And therefore, there's no doubt she'll be confirmed. What I'm talking about is the Republicans will try, many will try to depict her as kind of an effete liberal elitist, and that will be kind of what the battle's about. It will be a battle for public opinion, not a battle to decide whether she gets confirmed or not. She will be confirmed.
I want to pick up on some of her views a little bit later on in the program, but I think we should talk a little bit about her biography, because Stuart, Michael Shear just mentioned there the fact that she could serve for 40 mm-hmm. years, 30, 40 years. Does the fact that she is a woman and a 50-year-old play into her selection process?
Oh, absolutely.
I think
presidents want to use these choices, and I mean, this is the second one President Obama has had. He'll maybe get another one, depending on how things play out and whether or not he gets a second term. But they want to make a lasting impact. They don't want to pick somebody who's going to be on there for a fairly limited period of time. And President Obama has talked a lot about diversity on the court. Obviously, picking the first Latina last time, another woman this time. And so both of those go to his idea of reshaping, if not the ideological balance on the court, because we know it probably won't have a lot of effect on that, but at least to reshape the kind of outlook. And I think Stuart's right, that this characterization that they're likely to make of her as a kind of ivory tower liberal, whether or not it sticks, that's likely to be part of what comes. I'll just give one last thing here. As we were talking, John Kyle, who was one of those senators, Republican from Arizona, one of those senators who did vote for her last time, sent a statement I just got in my email box. As I made clear when I appointed her confirmation as Solicitor General, a temporary political appointment is far different than a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court. So you can already see
already lining themselves up.
It's interesting to see a nominee who does not have the kind of compelling personal story of Justice Sotomayor. Mm. She grew up on the Upper West Side. She's the second, the third Jew. She is the second New Yorker. Her dad was a lawyer. Her mom was a teacher. And Obama said he wants someone who understands the effect of the law on real Americans. They're already pointing to the fact that she started a pro bono program at Harvard Law School.
White House and Harvard, real America?
No, exactly. Yeah. But what's impressive, what I think is so telling, is that former Professor Obama clearly thinks that she will embrace his particular progressive constitutional vision. He said something very interesting right before he nominated her. He said liberals relied too much in the 1960s on the courts to fight their battles for them, and now it's conservatives who are relying on the courts to reverse their political defeats in areas from campaign finance to health care to economic reform. So he's more interested in Kagan as a kind of new Democrat who's going to defend judicial restraint, even though she may not have the kind of compelling personal narrative that people can immediately connect to.
Okay, and one other thing that the president said as he was announcing her was that Elena's mother would relish the fact that three women would be on the Supreme Court at the same time for the first time in history. Jeffrey Rosen is professor of law at the George Washington University and legal affairs editor of The New Republic. He's the author of The Supreme Court, The Most Democratic Branch, The Naked Crowd, and The Unwanted Gaze. You have written a lot, Jeffrey. Michael Shear is with us. He is White House reporter for The Washington Post. And on the phone we have Stuart Taylor. He is senior writer with National Journal magazine and contributing editor to Newsweek. He's the co-author with Casey Johnson of Until Proven Innocent, Political Correctness and the Shameful Injustices of the Duke LaCrosse Rape Case. We are discussing the nomination of Elena Kagan to be the next justice of the Supreme Court. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane. We are discussing the nomination of Elena Kagan to be the next Supreme Court Justice. The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. Our email address is drshow@wmu.org. We would love to hear your questions and comments on this incredibly important nomination for the president. Politics Daily has called her a Supreme Court choice perfectly positioned for confirmation. Jeffrey, just before we went to break, Michael brought up the point that Senator John Kyle, who had voted in favour of her as Solicitor General, has now said, of course, this is a very different process. Is Politics Daily right?
Yes, for the reasons that Stuart and Michael gave. She's got at least 65 votes. She will be confirmed. Now, the question of whether the attacks on her, especially from the right, will do much damage is interesting, but it's so hard to paint her as a doctrinaire liberal, that I don't think they will. I mean, Stuart mentioned the conservative case against her is her support of banning the military from campus because of her opposition to gays in the military. But 70 law school professors signed this position. As Solicitor General, she's defended aspects of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. She can pretty easily say, I was representing the views of the faculty. I was arguing that it should be decided on statutory rather than constitutional grounds. There are lots of ways around it. And and what's interesting is she said in her last confirmation hearing she does not believe there's a constitutional right to gay marriage. She said she's agreed with the president that you can detain enemy combatants pretty broadly under certain circumstances. I think in the end, the case against her from the left is more compelling than the one against her from the right. The right really has to caricature her, where the left might legitimately wonder whether she'll move the court a bit to the
right. And some left-wing bloggers have already suggested that this could be a mistake on the president's part, that he might be nominating somebody who actually turns out to be more conservative than people think at the moment, Stuart Taylor. Is that a possibility, that he's nominating somebody whose views are not entirely clear and, as have some justices in the past, might turn out to be not exactly what one thought they were?
Certainly possible. She's been very careful to guard her views, as I think has been pointed out. People say they've never, who know her well, say they've never had a conversation with her about any Supreme Court issue. I think her background, the places she's chosen to be in life, the administration she's chosen to work for, do suggest that she'd definitely be a member of the court's, the fourth member of the court's liberal bloc, but maybe not as liberal as Justice Stevens, which translates to making the Supreme Court a bit more conservative, simply because Stevens was very, very liberal, and she may be a little less so. And the one issue where you can, I think, you can be fairly confident in predicting she may not be as liberal as Justice Stevens is the whole question of presidential power, war powers, terrorism versus civil liberties, where both in her confirmation testimony and as Solicitor General, she has defended positions that President Obama has adopted with some changes from the much reviled, in liberal circles, Bush administration. As Jeff pointed out, her job as Solicitor General is to defend Obama's policies, but I think there's been no hint that she doesn't agree with them. And there's a little bit of a continuity between her academic work and her current work on these issues, and therefore there's something to that complaint from the left. However, I just got a press release this morning from Nan Aaron of the Alliance for Justice, which has long been a pretty staunch liberal advocate of liberal causes and confirmation proceedings, and they're applauding the nomination. So I think these complaints from the left are kind of coming from pretty far to the left. I think mainstream liberals are fine with this nomination.
Michael, Jeffrey touched on it just now, but if we assume that she does get confirmed, and the likelihood seems to be that she will do, that the president will get his pick, how does she affect the Supreme Court? And she has a long time. If she lives a long and healthy life, she has a long time to sit there. How do you see her shaping the court, not just in terms of its political direction, but I was struck by one person over the weekend who described her to me as a potential star, as a leader on the court.
Well, I think Jeffrey is right. When he talked about, her reputation as a conciliatory, as somebody that brings folks together, this is what that aides say President Obama was looking for, was somebody who could go onto that court and not just be a reliable vote, but to be somebody who over time, I mean, I think it takes time. This is an institution, after all, that's weighted down with a lot of tradition and what have you, but that over time she would become somebody who not only would be a vote, but would be able to bring together folks, hopefully majority of folks from their perspective, five votes, to actually push the ideals and the principles that the president believes in. I do want to get to at some point, though, there's also another context here, and nobody wants to talk about it, really. Certainly the White House doesn't, but there's a political context, a raw politics context to all of this, which is that this nomination is going to be playing out, and the fight is going to be playing out just before a midterm election, in which both sides have an interest in how it plays out and what arguments are made, whether or not there's nothing that fires up the bases of both parties like a good, solid, confirmation fight. And will she be not liberal enough to fire up the left? Will she be, as Jeff says, not, controversial enough to get the right all riled up? How does that affect other pocketbook issues like the economy, jobs, and maybe healthcare, which sort of had been rising to the fore in the campaign? All of that's going to be playing out, and you can bet that the White House is trying to figure out how that's going to work for
them. Right, but Michael, there are fights and fights. And it depends how far the Republicans want to push this one, right?
Both sides. It depends on how both sides. I mean, if Jeff is right, and if this doesn't, if it's really a fight on the left, then maybe the right wing maybe this doesn't rile up the right the base, which frankly maybe doesn't need to be riled up from the right's perspective. They've got the Tea Party and everything else that going on there. You know, I've talked to folks in the Senate who on the left who would have liked at some level to see a big fight over abortion or something just to get the left fired up.
Okay. Jeffrey, I want to pick up a little bit more on her relations with the other members of the court.
Yes.
And how she might affect those other members, particularly the swing voters. People have suggested that she is somebody that might be able to persuade Justice Kennedy, for example, to join the liberal bloc.
Yes, indeed. Winning over Justice Kennedy is what Kagan might be very well equipped to do, and he can be swayed in some cases. And she's devoted her whole life to winning over precisely someone like him, to argue in terms he can understand, to frame the issues in ways that he can accept. And in the end, this is why I think she will be a star, and she might be more of a leader even than Stevens, who in the end was really a lone dissenter for much of his career, considered himself a judicial conservative until the end. As a young, committed, politically savvy justice, Kagan has the opportunity to really bring the court to the left in that way. And in that sense, she puts the left, who are the people who are opposing her, and there aren't a lot of them, in a funny position because they were initially very supportive of Justice Sotomayor because of her demographics, but then were sort of disappointed by Sotomayor's performance in her confirmation hearings, where she incanted the usual conservative mantra about interpreting the law, not making it. And then there's this concern about whether Sotomayor's former trial judge is really interested in playing that leadership role on the court. I think Obama must have calculated this time, all right, I may have only one more shot. I really care about this. I've taught constitutional law. I want someone who's going to be a standard bearer for my vision of liberal, progressive judicial restraint into the 21st century. And he thought that Kagan could do that better than anyone else.
Stuart Taylor, do we see a big new force on the Supreme Court in Elena Kagan?
I think she certainly has the mind and the personality to be a big new force to the extent it's possible to be a big new force. I think you can't overestimate the ability of any new junior justice to influence any justice who's been sitting on the court for a long time. That's not a cut against against Elena Kagan, of whom I have a very high opinion, but as Chief Justice Rehnquist, the late Chief Justice, once said, the Supreme Court justices we have now are all as independent as hogs on ice. None of them is very subject to influence by any of the others, let alone by the new kid on the block. So I wouldn't hold my breath for everyone to be dancing to Elena Kagan's tune.
Okay, I want to go to a comment that's come to us from Facebook, and it says, I think that the court is becoming alarmingly out of touch with the public. There will be one judge from the West, no Protestant judges, and no judges from a school that is not within the Ivy League. Michael, that's a fair point, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the areas of diversity that that has been going essentially in the wrong direction from the perspective of many, especially folks at the White House. You know, there's a funny note to make, and I'm not exactly sure what the number is, but I think there may be one justice for every borough in New York at this point. I mean, maybe four of the five. You know, there much of this court is kind of East Coast, Northeast.
All Harvard or Yale.
Harvard, Yale, Ivy League. I mean, you know, there's very little to sort of represent in that sense the rest of the country. Now, that's not what the court's supposed to do necessarily. This is different than a political, right, Jeff, a political election.
Well, the question is, what would it mean to represent the whole country? It strikes me there's not an Upper East Side justice, I think.
Okay, there you go.
Scalia and Alito are from different places. But when people say the court's out of touch, they point to things like the Citizens United campaign finance decision, which is opposed by 80% of the country, by Republicans almost to the same degree as Democrats. The question is, do you have to be someone from the West or someone from a political background to be able to represent the views of the people who are upset with the court's anti-corporate slant? And that's why it's going to be so interesting to watch Democrats in the hearings. Senator Pat Leahy, for the past couple of years, has been holding hearings on the way the court is out of touch with ordinary Americans in these corporate finance cases. Senators Franken, Klobuchar, and White House are all interested in these issues. This is if Kagan is going to get heat from sympathetic Democrats, it's going to be this issue that they're focusing on. Can you represent the views of ordinary Americans? Or even as Obama said when he chose someone, he said he wants someone who can represent the powerless against the powerful. I don't know what Kagan's views on business cases are. She hasn't had a lot of experience, but probably her experience in running Harvard Law School, which is a multi-million dollar corporation, probably influenced her views more than anything else. And I think it's legitimate to ask how she will stand on these positions. The knock against the Roberts Court is not a partisan one. Democrats like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer have joined many of these pro-corporate decisions to similar extent as conservatives. 80% of these business decisions are 7-2 or higher or unanimous. So in terms of ideological diversity, this is the one voice that does not appear on the court, economic populism. And senators are going to ask Kagan, how can you reassure us that you actually will stand up for ordinary people's economic interests?
Stuart Taylor, can she?
I think she can certainly speak well when questioned in confirmation about it. But like all recent nominees, she will be very assiduous in not disclosing what she thinks about any substantive issue. So she'll probably say the kinds of things the president has said about, he wanted a name of justice with, quote, a keen understanding of how the law affects the daily lives of American people. But she won't tell you exactly what she is going to do on any particular kind of case that affects the lives of the American people. And of course, liberal populism is seen by many as the salvation of the country and seen by others as bad for little people as well as big people. So there are a lot, there's no consensus. These are hard issues, and we won't know much more, if any more, after the confirmation hearing than we do now about exactly where a Justice Kagan will come down on these issues.
Stuart Taylor, a senior writer with National Journal magazine. I'm Katty Kay of BBC World News America. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. We are going to go to the phones to Tony in Alexandria, Virginia. Tony, you've joined The Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I think it's great that you all are talking about being out of touch with the people. And I think a lot of listeners, when they hear journalists and academics talk about it, it's something that, it sort of makes us laugh. My question was, with her serving on the board, I think an advisory board with Goldman Sachs, how can we really, and not doing anything to stop what happened, how we can consider her to be in touch with the people? She's obviously in touch with the big banks. So if you all can talk about that. Thank you.
Okay. I mean, Tony raises an interesting point, especially in terms of the timing and her relationship with Goldman Sachs, when there are a few more reviled institutions in the public perception. And this is clearly Goldman is the target of much of the public anger about the crash on Wall Street. Is this going to be a problem for her, Jeffrey Rosen, during the confirmation hearings?
It may be. As I say, this is what senators are going to be focusing on. And the question
specifically
of whether,
her relationship with Goldman Sachs.
No. But the question of whether she, in fact, will challenge the court's pro-corporate bias. And the Obama administration is divided on this question. Paul Volcker and Elizabeth Warren, who some thought should have been on the Supreme Court shortlist, represent the Louis Brandeis tradition of the curse of bigness and how the corporations are taking great risks with other people's money. But Tim Geithner and other economic advisors, Larry Summers, are very much in that Goldman pro-investment bank tradition. Obama hasn't come down clearly on one side or the other. I think it's fair to fear that Elena Kagan, who's not thought deeply about these issues, the fact that she's on the board doesn't tell us too much. But there's certainly no evidence in her record that she's more on the Brandeis side than the Goldman Sachs side. So she's going to get very close questions from these on these issues. And the law review article that she will most regret writing, this is the one prediction I'm confident of, is one where she said that senators in confirmation hearings should ask very probing questions of nominees. Conservatives are already calling this the Kagan standard, and they're certainly going to apply that Kagan standard to her.
Michael, it's interesting to me that we're talking about economics and her relationship with business and her attitude, her legal attitude to business. We're not talking about what have been the traditional hot-button social issues, abortion, gun rights, that kind of thing.
I think that's partly a reflection of the times we're in, right? The economic crisis of the last, year and a half, and the sort of slow recovery, jobless recovery. I mean, there are some that are coming back has shaped what people care about and what they want to talk about to allow and that filters up. That filters up to the court. I do think that, you know, the Goldman thing will probably be out there, probably be a question. I think though her compensation was a total of about $10,000 is what I had read, which, you know, given the billions and trillions of dollars flowing through those kinds of firms, I think it's an indication that she wasn't sort of at the heart, and nobody's going to be able to accuse her of being at the heart of whatever transpired at that firm.
But you don't expect Roe v. Wade to be a big issue during these confirmation hearings?
You know, it's always an issue. It will always be an issue. It briefly came up a few days back when President Obama was asked about how much that was going to be part of his selection process, and he answered it in a particular way, and folks started parsing it. It will come up, but I would be surprised if it's a big central issue.
Michael Scheer is with The Washington Post. I also have with me Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at the George Washington University. Stuart Taylor with National Journal magazine is on the line. We're discussing the nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. Of course, the nomination just announced in the last hour by President Obama. I'm Katty Kay. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news and politics, culture and lifestyle at Germany.info, by the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at MelvilleTrust.org, and by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
A recent survey found almost one-third of teenagers say they've experienced dating violence. How to recognize the signs of abuse and what can be done to prevent it. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're discussing the nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. I'm joined in the studio by Jeffrey Rosen, professor of law at the George Washington University. Michael Scheer is here as well. He's White House reporter for The Washington Post. Stuart Taylor is on the phone, senior writer with National Journal magazine. The phone number here is 1-800-433-8850. Our email address is drshow@wmu.org. We would love to hear from you, and I'm going to go straight to the phones after this short break. It is Benjamin in Daytona Beach, Florida. Benjamin, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome.
I wanted to ask your guests what they thought about, you've spoken about elitism and the whole idea that the court is out of touch with the people, and everyone always calls for this sort of that a nominee for the Supreme Court should have the opinions and the views of the everyman sort of at the front of their mind, so they're not supporting this sort of elitist caste of people, I suppose you could call it. But I wanted to ask, has there ever really been a point in history where even our Senate or our House has truly represented the demographics of the people, and necessarily, the fact that all the justices have gone to Ivy League schools and there's no Protestants. Is that really a big deal that affects the way the court operates so much, or is that just sort of a tactic used in confirmation hearings to sort of discredit someone?
Interesting point, Benjamin. Stuart Taylor, what do you think? Is it really an issue? Is it something that Americans need to be concerned about? I mean, it seems to me that, the Supreme Court is what probably the country's 9 top lawyers. It's fairly unsurprising that they're going to come from the cream of the crop.
Yes, of course, traditionally, there's been a lot of Harvard, there's been a lot of Yale, although not nearly as much as these days when it's all Harvard and all Yale on the Supreme Court, or at least will be after Elena Kagan joins. The Supreme Court are elite lawyers, and therefore you don't really expect them to be a cross-section of the population with stevedores and so forth. And there's only 9 of them, and so they can only represent so many different types of people. I do think that there's something to the idea that with 6 Harvards and 3 Yales, with a very large preponderance of East Coast establishment, with a new nominee who has spent her entire professional career working in, law schools, never until she was Solicitor General in courtrooms, never kind of out in the hinterland, always in the precincts of power. I think there are things to talk about there, but I want to emphasize none of this casts any doubt about her confirmation. It's all about kind of political positioning for various people. Democratic senators, as Jeff was indicating, will want to, want to show that they're on the case about making sure she's going to be tough on the corporate elite. Republican senators will be trying to portray her as part of the liberal elite, and it's not a good time to be a member of any elite, and imagine she'll come across as a kind of anti-elitist, no matter how elite her credentials.
Jeffrey, should we make a distinction between diversity and elitism?
Yes, I think I'm bristling. My elitist knee is jerking.
I could see it.
At all of this elite bashing. It's not as if someone who went to the Ivy League can't be an economic populist. And when you think about, there have been only 3 justices who've held Justice Stevens' seat in this century: Louis Brandeis, William O. Douglas, and John Paul Stevens. Brandeis and Douglas were the greatest economic populists of this century. They were passionate advocates of the dangers of corporate bigness and the importance of the small scale and ordinary workers. Both of them were elitists by their standards. Brandeis, the top of his class at Harvard Law School. Douglas, a Yale law professor, the head of the SEC. We are confusing a substantive position, which is not represented on this court. There's not a single economic populist, to use the generalization, Democrat or Republican, on this court, we're confusing that with background. So I think it's kind of a cheap shot to. It's not a cheap shot. It's an interesting shift. How was it, as one of your callers suggested? It used to be geographic diversity mattered. You had to have a Westerner and an Easterner, and not just on in the borough of Manhattan, but across the country as a whole. You had to have a religious slot. Now geography doesn't matter. Religion doesn't matter. Race and gender does matter. But the one thing that's not represented on this court is what Obama said, which is true diversity of economic views. And that's worth thinking hard about.
But I would just say, I think part of the reason that criticism of her, or that question about her, is going to be raised with some more urgency is because there's very little in a record or a writing to suggest that despite her sort of outward, the credentials, that she does have that kind of economic populist view. So, having nothing else to put your hands around, you sort of go immediately to the question of, well, what's her background? So that'll be an interesting exploration.
Okay, let's go to Michael in Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Michael. You've joined the program.
Yeah, I was wondering about something.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I heard John Dean say the other day that there are no more real liberals, classical liberals like William Douglas, William Brennan, and Thurgood Marshall on the court anymore. And he suggested that if Miss Kagan were picked, she would be more of a watered-down liberal, if you will. And I was wondering, can your guest speak to that? And also, the lady from the BBC, I know this is off the question, but I was curious about your prime minister, Mr. Brown. Is he going to make it? Or
I think you'll have to stay tuned to the news for the BBC question, but I'm going to get back to Elena Kagan and Stuart Taylor. What do you think? What are the chances of her being a real liberal in the... Jeffrey was talking about it a little bit earlier, the absence of one, an economic populist, at least, on the Supreme
right.
Court. Could she be in that mold?
I'd say that nothing in her record so far would lead me to think that she's going to be an economic populist in the sense that Jeff's talking about, you know, a passionate economic populist, a Brandeis, big is bad type economic populist. We haven't had anybody like that on the Supreme Court for a long time, nor have we had a classic crusading social liberal like Justice Brennan or Justice Marshall on the court in a long time. And I might suggest that one reason for that isn't just that we've lost that old-time liberal religion. I'd suggest that one reason for it is that the gigantic structural injustices in American society, represented by racial apartheid above all, that were broken in part by Brown versus Board of Education and the apportionment problems, that there were problems in American society that kind of called for crusading liberal Supreme Court activism in a way that I think it's hard to find issues today that call for that. Do we really want the Supreme Court to try and find a way to break up Goldman Sachs, or do we want to leave that sort of thing to Congress? Now, I do think should be deferential to Congress, unlike some of the court's conservatives, if Congress decides to break up Goldman Sachs, for example, and that's appropriate.
Jeffrey.
It's interesting. This is something that President Obama addressed in his book, The Audacity of Hope. He has a whole chapter on the Constitution, and it's a fascinating chapter. And he says something he repeated recently: liberals in the 60s relied too much on the courts to fight their battles. He also said the great advances for liberty and equality throughout American history have come more from grassroots political activism rather than from judicial fiat, and that judges can nudge or can slow things down a bit, but they can't fight liberal battles. So there's a philosophical battle of the most interesting kind between a small number of old-style liberals who yearn for a return to these romantic 60s days and Obama constitutionalists who think judges should most of all defer to Congress and let the political process do its thing. They can do stuff on the margins, but it's both wrong and also politically foolish to yearn for a return to the Warren Court. In our lifetime, we're not going to see a majority of William Brennan's, even if people wanted it. So this is a place where Obama has a strong, well thought out, and I should say I find convincing view, and he's emphatically rejected a return to this old style nostalgic vision.
One thing that struck me talking to people that knew Elena Kagan from Harvard was how they almost described her in the same terms that people have described Obama to me, who knew him at Harvard. In the same sort of mold of somebody almost like you're describing, Jeffrey, of somebody who is going to bring both sides together rather than rapidly go for one side or the other.
It's a fascinating comparison. Both their similarities of biography, that they've been at the same places, and this urge of bipartisanship, which has eluded Obama. He came in talking about the need to bring both sides together and failed, and also has eluded John Roberts. And this is an interesting, another Harvard personality to put into the mix. Roberts came onto the court saying he wanted to do the same thing that Obama said, which is to convince liberals and conservatives to converge on narrow, unanimous opinions. Many people think that he's failed in that goal, as the Citizens United case shows. So could the dynamics change with Kagan up there? One thing we haven't talked about, there have been some sharp exchanges between Roberts mm-hmm. and Kagan, and some wonder, is Roberts threatened by her? Does he think that she'd be really effective and if she got onto the court, and was he trying to keep her off? Or was he just sparring with someone he really views as an intellectual equal? And to the degree that dynamic changes, if she could get up there and do what Obama, Roberts, and she throughout her career have tried to do, but no one has succeeded yet in doing, that would be a tremendous change in the dynamic of the court.
Stuart Taylor, can you read the Supreme Court tea leaves?
Yes, I can't. It is puzzling why Chief Justice Roberts has kind of been so oppositional to her, you know, has been so harsh on her in some of his questioning. But I think, as I indicated before, I think nobody is better qualified in terms of personal qualities than Elena Kagan. to bring a new era of goodwill to the Supreme Court in terms of ideological comedy. But I don't think even she is going to have much ability to do that, at least in the short term, maybe over the period space of 10 or 20 years. But I don't think Justice Kennedy is going to suddenly start seeing the world differently because of the picture Elena Kagan paints for him.
Okay, let's just go to George in St. Augustine, Florida. George, you've joined the program.
Thank you very much. I am an attorney and have practiced for about 35 years, and I think it's natural to expect justices to be informed by their experiences and background, notwithstanding all the uproar about the wise Latina woman comment of Justice Sotomayor. What bothers me, though, is that the narrowness of the selection of justices, in my opinion, is evidenced by the fact that very few of them, Justice Sotomayor being a small exception, have experience in the courtroom. Very few of them have truly represented clients and understand the effect of the exclusionary rule, understand the impact of various decisions that are made on people's lives in the courtroom. They may have great political understanding or understanding of social issues or things like that, but none of these understand how their decisions affect individual practicing attorneys and their clients.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. Michael Shearer, I want you to pick up on George's comments there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes partly to the point that I think Jeff was making before about how many different aspects the president goes through to try to figure out who to nominate here. And there are only nine of them. And so they, you know, one of the things that that will be a critique of her is this. There's a critique of the fact that she hasn't been a judge, so she hasn't been in that courtroom. You know, George was talking about being in, actually watching the trials. She doesn't have any. You know, the line I think that the conservatives are throwing out there is not a single day in a robe. At least not one a judge's robe, anyway, that we know of. The other thing that I wanted to bring up that's interesting from before George's comment was, you know, there's also a bit of tension, a bit more tension than we've ever sort of seen in recent years between the president and the chief justice, who have sort of had this ongoing back and forth tension that may play out in interesting ways as Elena Kagan goes up there and is another representative, essentially, from Barack Obama on that court.
But we should point out that it's only in the last few decades, isn't it, Jeffrey, that it was the norm for justices to come from the bench?
Absolutely. A majority of the justices who decided the Brown versus Board of Education case were the one that struck down school segregation in 1954, were former politicians, a former governor, Earl Warren, a former attorney general, head of the Security and Exchange Commission. There were no former judges on the court that decided Brown. This court has all former judges and no politician. Now, will Kagan take the politician's role of being politically savvy and building alliances? After all, she's not a politician. She worked in the executive branch like most of the rest of them, and in that sense doesn't add to experiential diversity. There's a good argument that she will, and in that sense, I think Obama just this no experience rap is not going to resonate so much. He's more interested in just having someone argue his position than come in with a judicial track record.
We just have a couple of minutes left on the program, and I want to bring up something that Orrin Hatch said a year ago about Elena Kagan. She said, "You have to admit, Elena Kagan is a brilliant woman. She is a brilliant lawyer. If Obama picks her, it is a real dilemma for people." And that was on the idea of her being picked for the Supreme Court. Michael Schur, kind of summing up there the problem that Republicans face, right, in terms of the confirmation hearings.
Right. And it also goes back to Jeff's point about the sort of dilemma, where does the left and where does the right, you know, where do they engage on this nomination? You know, Hatch's statement today came out, of course, "I will examine Ms. Kagan's entire record to understand her judicial philosophy. I have an open mind and look forward to actively participating." I mean, there's going to be a lot of that for the next couple of days as senators like Senator Hatch and others kind of sense where the public is and where their colleagues are as they position themselves. This is a long process. This takes 6 or 7 weeks before we will likely get to a hearing. There will be a period of examination where Ms. Kagan will answer questions that the committee will pose to her. There will be a lot of outside investigations, reporters, others that will be, you know, combing through her record. And so there is going to be this kind of feeling out period until folks know how that all turns out.
Very, very briefly before we go, we expect her to be confirmed by when, do you think, Michael, if she is?
I think the target is the first week of July. First week, maybe second week of July. There's a congressional break there, and they'd like to get it done before then, if possible.
It's going to be a very interesting few weeks. Michael Scheer is the White House reporter for The Washington Post. Jeffrey Rosen has also been with me, professor of law at the George Washington University. Stuart Taylor has joined us on the line. He's senior writer with National Journal magazine. We've been discussing this very interesting pick of President Obama's Elena Kagan, just announced as the president's next nominee for the Supreme Court. We will watch those confirmation hearings. I'm Caddy Kay of the BBC. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.